there is a lot of work that has been done already. There's a lot of research into both online learning and into blended learning. And we think that this MEANS U.S. Department of Education study is probably the best place to start. And basically what they did in their meta-analysis is that they found that face-to-face and purely online have about the same learning outcomes, but where you get a little bit of an advantage is in blended learning, and in fact that's what this research is about, blended learning in physics. For MOOCs, I'm sure you guys know, the jury is still out. We're still trying to figure out how we can take advantages of the biases of MOOCs, how we can use them for social interaction, and most importantly, for the people who are doing them, how we get students to persist. How many of you actually are MIT undergrads or teach undergrads or know anything about undergrads? Okay, so back in 2000, a group of physics faculty moved 801 and 802, Physics 1 and Physics 2, from lecture recitation to something called TEAL, Technology-Enabled Active Learning. It was already, in that sense, a blended class. But in 2013, that same group decided that they wanted to take the materials that they had put on the web and put them into the edX, MITx, whatever you want to call it, platform. They hired us. The main guy was my husband. He had no choice to do a study. Oops, somewhere that got screwed up. And we've done both quantitative and qualitative research methodologies. So Jen had a graduate student who was an expert at data mining. We looked at all of the clicks that the students, the on-campus students, made as they used the material that was on the edX platform. Not the MOOCs, but the material that had been developed for TEAL and then put into the MITx platform. So we looked at the clickstream data. In particular, this talk is going to focus on how the students use something called the checkable answer feature, which gave them immediate feedback as to whether or not their answers to online problem sets were right or wrong. We have demographic data, thanks to the registrar's office. We did a survey to ask the students how they felt about this new blended learning environment. We did interviews, and we actually watched students work online in teams and do what's called think aloud, so that they told us what they were thinking about as they worked through an online problem. So we've got this mixed methods study, and with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jen to tell you what our research questions were and what we found out.
All right.
Thank you, Lori. Good afternoon, everybody. It's great to be here with you. So to transition from Lori's introduction, I wanted to emphasize this last point, that this is really bringing together a lot of different types of information, and we're having to use a number of different tools to analyze this information. So I'll be highlighting findings that include insights from traditional predictive statistics, from data mining, which includes two different kinds of clustering, which I'll mention, and from qualitative research, where we're in somewhat uncharted waters, and we used grounded theory to make sense of students' experience in this space. So I'll organize the findings by our key research questions, which were identified through conversations within this multifaceted research team, which again included my group at Purdue's Department of Engineering Education, the Teaching and Learning Lab, which has a number of resources and expertise in teaching college and university students and understanding how they learn, as well as the subject matter experts and instructional team from 801. So we agreed on two key research questions that I'll talk about, and we'll close with the third research question, which is, so what? So what do we do with this? So the first research question was really about resource choice. So as students are moving through this complex environment, what can we see about their choices that they're making, what resources they have decided to use, and what study strategies they're employing as they go through Physics 1 through 801. So to start off with some of the insights from quantitative information, and this is thanks to the data mining tools deployed by my graduate student, Cindy Chen. First, we wanted to see whether all of the behaviors we could identify could be grouped into clusters of behaviors, into sets of behaviors that operate in a similar fashion. So along the bottom, I'm just going to highlight that we have groups of behavioral metrics that cluster together, including, for example, the fact that students are using a host of online resources. They're not just looking at videos, they have an e-text, they have class slides that they can refer to. If you want to see more information about all of the behaviors we identified, this is from a publication at FIE, the Frontiers in Education Conference, from this past fall. But really, I'm going to be focusing on the ones that I highlight up here. So we looked at all of these behaviors and wanted to determine whether the students in 801 grouped themselves into behavioral types. If there was a student who really used all of the resources in one way, and then there's another set of students who use the resources in another way, if there are really prototypical types of students that we could identify. We were somewhat surprised to see that there are really only two clusters of types of students. This is a pretty diverse class that all freshmen have to take. And this was, I think, 474 students in this case. But we really only were able to identify two types of students based on their behaviors. And one performed significantly better than the other. The higher performing group of students was more actively engaged with online feedback and anecdotally with feedback from other resources like their peers or their instructors. So the role of feedback was important for the higher performing group. This included starting their problem sets early so that they would actually get more opportunities to check their answers and engage in the checkable answer features feedback. This included more problem solving sessions. This included actually checking their answer more times. So those students who were checking on all of their online problems and their written problems correctness were getting more feedback and were doing better in the course. This also included, for the higher performing group, that even if their first check was incorrect, the first time they checked on the answer for a problem that they could submit to the online platform, as long as they kept going, those students actually did better. This was counterintuitive to what the course team and indeed what we had hypothesized. We thought that the better performing students would be the ones who get the answer right away. They already know physics, so they can kind of breeze through this class. And that wasn't the case. It was more important for students to actually get that feedback and use it and keep going, persisting even after they got the answer wrong. I'll talk more about some of the qualitative insights that we got later that can complement this and really let us know what students are thinking, what they're doing after they get a question wrong from the checkable answer feature. And we also see that consistently, the students who are in this better performing group are using all of the other resources a little bit more. Now, this isn't a huge difference in terms of their use of the videos or the e-text or any of these other resources, but it was consistent across all of the types of blended resources that they could use. Another thing that we found in terms of their study strategies is that they were more strategic and spaced out their engagement with the resources at their disposal. There was a longer time between each check, and by that I mean a student would check whether or not their answer was right, and then there was more time before the second check that student would make. So rather than putting in an answer, getting it wrong, and 5 seconds later trying another answer, the students in the higher performing group were having longer amounts of time, more time for them to actually reflect on that answer that they got wrong before they tried another answer. there were shorter intervals between what we called problem-solving sessions. Less time in between, I'm going to work on my homework now for about an hour, and then tomorrow I'm going to work on it again for an hour. So less time in between those sessions where I'm sitting down and engaging with the platform. And those students in the higher performing group would make sure to check their answer until they got it correct. So again, persisting and continuing to engage with the online feedback system until they got their answer correct. And now this was true even for the homework problems that they didn't have to turn in online. There were two types of problems, I should explain. There were online homework problems where they only had to submit their answers online. And there were written homework problems where they could actually check the answer, but they ultimately had to hand it in written out. They weren't required to check it online. But those students who would persist until they got the answer right in the online framework, even when they weren't required to, performed better in the course. Now, we also, as Lori mentioned, did 18 interviews with students in this class. And what emerged was a framework for the way in which they strategically selected resources to use. So out of all 18 interviews, we were able to discern overall that the resource choices that they made were fairly strategic. They weren't haphazardly trying different resources until they got the right answer. They were more strategic about which online resources they were going to use. And now, more specifically, we identified 7 sub-themes, or buckets, that I'll describe in more detail. And these sub-themes were distinct ways in which they would make the decision about which online resources to use. Now, all of these sub-themes were moderated by 3 important factors. How much time the students had. So this means, really, how much time before that problem set is due? How much time before the exam? How much time do I have, and how will that factor into the way I choose to use online or blended resources? The setting, whether they were in class or at home in their dorm, whether they were working alone or with others, and the purpose. Were they looking for learning materials in order to study? Were they looking for learning materials because they had to get their homework done? What was the purpose for engaging with the learning materials? So all of this informed the way in which students chose to use learning materials to learn introductory physics. Now let me run through each of these 7 sub-themes in more detail. First, previous experience. This was the fall of 2014. So for most of the students, not all, for most of the students, this was one of their first college classes. And in nearly all of the interviews, we found that students hadn't had a blended class like this before. So they didn't have prior experience to draw on to say, this is how I'm going to function in a blended class. What they did instead was they drew on whatever cognates, whatever analogs they could see. If they had had a class in high school where they used some sort of e-text, that was something that they drew on to help them figure out how to navigate this blended course. Parallel experiences. Now, again, these are students who are in their first semester at MIT, and the only other analogs they have for a college experience class are the other courses that they're taking at the same time. So a number of students talked about how the way in which they succeeded or didn't succeed in navigating the other courses they were taking at the same time would inform how they would go through their 801 experience. Perceived preference. Students talked a lot about this personal affinity for certain resources. I like the e-text, that's just me. They also talked about being aware or not aware of the plethora of resources that were there for them. So this is a straightforward theme that we identified, because if they didn't know about a resource, they weren't going to use it. But it was something that ran through all of our interviews. Ease of use was a theme that came came up again and again. And now by this, I mean not only knowing how to use something like the e-text or the online videos, but also what the students described as the level of confusion in navigating a certain resource. Evaluation of utility was an important theme for students. They had made judgments about which resources were useful to them, and that was an important determinant of whether or not they were going to use that resource to learn. And then finally, level of activeness. So students preferred more interactive resources for two reasons. One is that those kinds of resources provide more immediacy. So something like the checkable answer feature, for example, will immediately tell you whether you got the answer right or wrong. And the other piece was that they had something to provide in return. Going to office hours has an immediate benefit in terms of learning how to learn the concepts needed for a given homework assignment. So I'm going to highlight some key quotes, not from all of these sub-themes, but I find it illustrative to actually let the students speak for themselves and to underscore some of these sub-themes that came up in our analysis. So prior experience. Let me pause and let you skim that briefly. So here you have a student who, in high school, he or she had used e-texts and interacted with them on a tablet. And so he or she is using that to inform the choice to engage with the e-text for this particular course. Ease of use. Now this is the interviewer's question and then the respondent. So this student perceives the e-text to actually be really difficult to use and is instead reading the text but then writing post-its and putting them on his or her desk or wall. Not quite what the designers might have intended, but this is his perception of the ease of using this resource and how he has to make sense of it. Evaluation of the utility of the resources. So here we have a student who's saying that, you know, the whole year, I've only really gotten the answer right on the first try once that I can think of. But even though it might be frustrating for her, this is still one of the most useful resources in her estimation. Finally, level of activeness or interactivity. Have a little bit more insight into what's going on in between those checks. She, in this case, is pointing out that the checkable answer feature is forcing her to reflect, forcing her to go back and look at her work. And that immediate return, but also the benefit that provides, is something that has reinforced the choice of using that feature in her learning process. As I said, time, purpose, and setting are all important mediators of these sub-themes and the way in which students use these resources. I want to highlight this one because I think it's important to, it's a good illustration of the purpose for these resources. And this was something that we had maybe five really explicit examples that we could have shown for students talking about the fact that if it's not before a test, or if it's not for doing homework, then they won't use a given resource. In this case, this is the class, the textbook. So if it's not before a test, I don't even normally look at those again. So I want to highlight as well a result that we got from our predictive statistics that we we were able to, again, get additional insights, complementary insights from the qualitative work. So we found that one of the most consistent positive predictors of performance was how far in advance students started the problem set. So they got more opportunities to get feedback, and it's probably related to other productive study strategies. So we see just a really clear trend between those students who are starting a week or more in advance of the due date of the homework and their predicted cumulative score. And this was something that held true even when we controlled for students' background and other behaviors on the site. So what's going on? What can we learn from actually talking to students about why this is the case? So here, I'll give you a minute to read this with some additional insight from actually just talking to the students. So here's a student. This is a probe follow-up question. The student has mentioned that he or she has changed study strategies. So the interview asks, okay, well, so does that have anything to do with the online materials? And the student talks about the online materials really pushing him or her to give themselves more time to use all of the resources that are available. So to move on to research question two, or other primary goal in digging into all these data, we wanted to understand the relationship between out-of- and in-class behaviors. So how are students navigating between the multiple environments where they get to interact with 801 material? So again, this is supposed to say descriptive statistics at the top. I'll just highlight one or two of the summary statistics from this whole class. And the first one is up here, the total number of hours spent in problem-solving sessions. Now again, these problem-solving sessions are sessions where the student is actually engaging with the online homework checker. And that's an average number of 27 hours per student over the whole semester. So more than a day of additional time where he or she is engaging with the course materials. So this class is truly blended in the sense that students are spending a fair number of hours per week in class, face-to-face, but also engaging with the material online. So what we found when actually talking to the students, again, and asking them how they made sense of this mixed environment, was that it wasn't anything about the online platform itself. The biggest thing was that the social dynamics of the course, the people, were what helped them to figure out how to navigate and move in and out of the face-to-face and online environment. So we saw three key sub-themes that students tended to work in groups outside of class. And now this is, we would expect that. We know that students are working in study groups and that that's an important part of getting through MIT. But this is the case even when it's not mandatory, and even though we have these 24/7 resources available to them, we still see the students' study experience dominated by working with their peers. We also saw that the norms and environment that we would observe in a traditional classroom setting is reflected in this blended setting as well. So even though we're in a new space where we have a host of digital materials, the way in which the environment of the class functions is quite similar. And by that I mean we see students' affective and attitudinal and emotional responses really paralleling what we would see in a traditional face-to-face class. We see that students care about things like perceived instructor distance or how close they feel to their instructor as still being something that matters in this space. And then the last piece, in general, students seem to prefer resources that are familiar to them and even the more traditional learning resources over things that are new or unfamiliar to them or less tested. Now there's one exception that I'll talk about as we close, and that's the checkable answer feature. And I'll return to our hypothesis as to why that's the case at the end. But so first, group work. Group work is a really important component to the student's experience in this class. Here's a quote where the interviewer is asking the student about the three-person group, which is their assigned seat in the 801 classroom. These are the three people they always work with. So we see here that for this group, they've been more or less put into these three-person groups in class, but that class, that three-person group is now their study group out when they're not in class as well. They've formed a social connection, even though that wasn't where this group emerged from. And then we have another student who's come into their study group via a more expected mechanism. They live in the same dorm. So this is an important part of, in this case, his study group interaction. And another quote on group work. I'll give you a second to read that. So this student talking about the role of the checkable answer feature really in mediating student collaborations in student discussion about who's got the right or wrong answer. Now they have really the decider sitting there and saying, okay, I can tell you if you're right or wrong when you are trying to work together to solve this problem. So again, the norms, another emergent theme was that the norms of the traditional face-to-face classroom transfer here. So this first quote is illustrative of the affective and emotional responses that we might see and that we know from prior research exist in a normal face-to-face class. So students feeling reticent to try and give a response in front of a lecture hall of 200 people is translated into the blended context here, where the student is responding to a question about the online discussion forum, Piazza. And she's reticent to post because, and even in this case where she can post anonymously, she's reticent to go up there and have people think that she's stupid if she asks a silly question. But she then recognizes that everybody's struggling, so they're all going through a similar experience. Another quote illustrating the dynamics and the way in which students have to learn their roles in group work and learn how to collaborate effectively. So this student has had to go through a learning process over the whole semester where, and actually earlier in the interview she mentioned she didn't really like these two people who are in her group. But she has learned to like them because they have learned to how to effectively collaborate and learned really their roles in the collaborative learning group that they're a part of. And so this, I'll let you read that and we'll unpack that. So this is actually at the end of the interview. This is the last question that's sort of standard in all the interviews. Okay, so is there anything else that you want to share with me? And the student shared that it was really important to her that, and this is back in the fall of 2014, there was a suicide that occurred a few weeks, I think, before this had happened, before we interviewed. And it meant a lot to her to feel like the instructor distance, which is often a kind of an obstacle for students in a college university classroom, that was bridged somewhat by the instructor talking about when he was younger, when he was a student. So finally, the third theme that we identified in students having to navigate the online and face-to-face environment was that in general, they preferred more familiar resources over novel resources. just wants to have a physical textbook. But I will say it was about half and half with both the interviews and the surveys that we did. Some students really do like aspects of the e-textbook, but we see this kind of preference when it comes to preferring to go directly to a TA in person, over, preferring that over the online discussion forum. And really just in general, the resources that students are used to, more traditional a classroom environment, is preferred over the novel resources that the blended environment offers. With one exception, and the exception is the checkable answer feature. Our hypothesis as to why this is the case is that there's no real traditional corollary to this. So the checkable answer feature in this case is what we would call an affordance. An affordance being not just what the technology can do, but what the users understand the technology to be able to do. The intersection between the properties of the product and the person. The checkable answer feature in this case is really a novel affordance that doesn't have a parallel in a traditional classroom. You don't 24/7 have your instructor there to say, yes, you got the right answer when you want to check your homework at 2 a.m. I'll offer two quotes from students sharing just how important this feature has been to them. So the student is talking about, you know, what we would perceive as a traditional structure where you do your homework, you turn it in, maybe a week or so later, you get feedback. This immediate feedback that's provided by the checkable answer feature allows the student to immediately know that it's wrong and keep trying until they really understand what has what was wrong in their problem-solving process. Here's another fun expression from the student. And really does sum up the consistent attitude of the students towards this particular feature. We'll close with research question three, which is really the, okay, so what do we do? How can we strengthen the type and the number of resources, as well as the pedagogical strategies that are incorporated into this kind of environment? And this is a good transition into our discussion, because we've posed a number of questions and a few suggested findings and insights from our work. So, what might explain what's going on here? Is it that students who have higher metacognitive ability are really able to navigate this environment and understand how the supports that they need to best learn? Is it also perhaps taking time for reflection? An important part of the use of the feedback process is reflecting. So we see that students in general are using the checkable answer feature in a reflective process. With the characteristics of both environments, the traditional and the digital environment, we may need to find a new equilibrium point. So we may still need to better understand which resources are best served in the online space and which resources fit more in our traditional structure. We see that education, really, at the end of the day, even with all this new technology, is a human endeavor. The other students in the class are one of the most important resources and one of the most important things that inform the student's experience. And we see that there's a suggestion that the checkable answer feature and its the affordance that it provides is really a good direction for future work. So we want to continue to push and ask ourselves what differences, if there are any, might exist between this context and what we know about traditional classrooms already. So with that, I'll come back to these discussion questions. I want to thank my research group team, our collaborators here in particular, Safe Ryan, but the whole 801 course team. And my graduate students and undergrads who have gone through a whole, I think it's about 100 gigs of quantitative data and 4,000 different nodes were part of the qualitative data set in order to make sense of this classroom. So thank you for your time, and we have about 15 minutes for questions.
Except what my husband and I talk about while we're brushing our teeth.
Yeah, so the longer answer is that the faculty, and I also want to thank Deepta Chakrabarti, who was the head instructor at this point in fall 2014 for 801. And we had Safe Around essentially as part of our research team in doing this. So in that way, we had a close link to the faculty. But in future work, and we've talked about potentially interviewing both faculty and the TAs, who are, as you saw from some of the students' answers, an important part of the process.
We should have. We just ran out of time, to be quite honest.
Yeah. So let's start here, and we'll go down this way.
So I'm just trying to figure out if I'm missing something related to the checkable answers. Mm-hmm. In the undergrad courses I took, maybe half the prompts in the textbook, you could flip to the back, and the answer would be there. Mm-hmm. So fundamentally, what's the difference between that and the checkable answers that they don't have?
Well, so the answers are not there. So you have to get the correct answer in order to then determine that it's correct. So you can't really look to, this is the exact answer. I think that's probably the most, I would argue there's other differences as well, but that's the fundamental difference.
Could you explain a little bit more about the context of the edX resources in the course? So were students were they following along with an edX course? Were they just using the checkable answers for homework? How did they use the resources?
There were a number of resources that had been developed for 801 and 802 that were then put on the edX platform. So they were not following along with the MOOCs. Those included some videos of faculty giving lectures, and included problem-solving sessions. It included the e-textbook, simulations and animations.
Right. Included class slides. So a number of the students talked about going back and referencing the class slides, because they would say, I remembered something that happened in class, and so I went, and it was easy to search, and I could find it. It also included things like, basic things like an office hours calendar, which actually a number of students mentioned and might be another actual affordance of this space, because they could immediately see, okay, for this week, this is who's available to talk to me. And again, a number of students mentioned that this was hugely helpful to them.
Were any of those things required for them to do, or was it just, here's extra stuff for you to learn from?
The online problem sets were required for them to do.
Okay.
But as I pointed out, the homework, the written homework, so there are online homework problems and written homework problems. So 4 out of the 6 problems that they had to do each week, they had to actually write out. And they weren't required to check, but they could.
Gotcha. Dan?
So my question is on time spent. So the mean study says that there could be confounding factor in the blended learning being better, and that students may have been spending more time. There were a couple other confounding factors in that study. Do you know the students in cluster A that performed better, were they spending more time than their counterparts in B? Not just more time on the online, but total.
So that's where it gets hard to actually unpack. So we have now with these data sets the ability to actually see when students are reading or watching videos or accessing any number of those resources out of class. Before any of the online resources were available, 30, 40 years ago, students were still studying outside of class, but we couldn't record it at all. So I would say right now we can't really tease apart those two things in terms of whether time on task is really explaining the difference in performance here.
But it is important to know that the 801 instructional team set a constraint that there would be no extra required time that students had to spend. So in a typical flipped classroom, one of the problems has been that the students are supposed to watch the lectures and then still have the same amount of classroom time. So you are adding time there. Here, we're not allowed to do that, in part because of this problem of the co-founding factors.
But, you know, people can spend more time if they wanted to.
Yeah, but again, students could always spend more time or less time.
In fact, my hypothesis would be that the ones that don't do well are not spending as much time as they probably should. But that's a negative.
So the one parallel to what you're saying was the point I made with where you see the distinction between two clusters of students, where it's a small but consistent pattern that the higher performing group is using those resources more. But again, we don't have a way of recording if they have the actual textbook how much time they're spending doing that.
So there is more time on task.
For these resources,
yes.
For the ones that we can record, yes.
When I used to teach physics a very long time ago, I was always bothered by the answers in the back of the book. For one thing, real life doesn't give you the answer in the back of the book. And for another thing, very often there isn't a single right answer, or there are very interesting wrong answers that can happen because a student took a particular step and made a wrong inference. I would be really interested in some kind of AI system that could actually follow the steps of inference in getting to an answer and then guide students and figure out at what step they went wrong. And I'm wondering if there are any systems that are making progress being able to do that kind of thing.
It's a hard question. There are intelligent tutoring systems that are trying to do just that. I will say, in this context, we sort of have the traditional analog to that, which is that the students were graded on the process that they followed to solve the written problems. So that was part of the reason for which there were online homework problems that they had to do and then written problems. And it was actually the process that they had to write out that they were also graded on. So there's that existed somewhat, but the intelligent tutoring systems, which you're talking about, are still, I would say, at their nascency.
But that's what they're trying to do.
That's
what they're moving toward.
And another big problem that came up was when calculators came along, and then students were getting answers that were 20 orders of magnitude off because they just punched the wrong key and didn't really think about what they were coming up with.
So
the anecdote about watching them think
aloud.
So I did watch several of these groups. Now this is completely anecdotal. We have not, we intend to, but we have not yet analyzed the videos from the ThinkAlab. And those videos are both of the student interactions and of what they're clicking through as they're working with the checkable answer feature. The one thing that heartened me as a teacher here at MIT is that even when they got that green check. So one student is kind of driving the computer. And even when that student gets a green check, if he or she is ahead of the other students in his or her group, and they know that the other student does not understand why they got a green check, they will stop and explain it and make sure that every student in the group understands at a deeper level why they got the green check. Now, I can't say that every MIT group does that, but I didn't think anybody did it, and it was really wonderful to see them do it.
And just to follow on that, what Lori's referring to, again, is the fact that we had, I think it was 17 video observations where students were recruited, and just as with the interviews, these were students in high, middle, and low performing, at high, middle, and low performing levels. And we said, okay, so come in, and you're going to solve one or two problems in front of us as you normally would using the checkable answer feature. And for, I think, about half of those students that we recruited, they brought another person, and one or two groups brought two other people with them because that's how they normally solve, that's how they normally do their homework. So again, the other student, the social dynamics, and their peers are such an important part of this puzzle. Janet, did you have a question?
There were a way, you know, if starting early and submitting early has such a big impact, or potentially has an impact, like, isn't there a way to, like, say, all right, everybody has to make five attempts between this time and this time, and then we're locking down the system, and then if they don't do that, they get dinged or something? I mean, is there a way to force people to behave better?
You do it and let us know how it works out, okay? I still have to worry about student evaluations.
Yeah. Well, so I think, is there a way with the platform? Yes, there's a way.
Right.
The sort of compromise that we made for this last semester in collaborating with the course team was to provide a summary of these findings as sort of a study guide. Our hope would be that, again, doing this in another round, refining that to make it useful for students and instructors, providing, I think they, you know, have a right to see this information now that we've found that, hey, starting early is good. And so we're trying to figure out the best way to communicate that to them, and then they hopefully will make the right decision with that information.
And I should say that the study guide is only like a page and a half.
Yeah.
So we understand the constraints of cognitive processing. Mm-hmm. Do we still have time?
Yeah,
we've
got time. You've got time.
Okay.
A follow-up question about the starting early effect. Does it matter when you start early? Did you need to start early before the material was covered in lecture? Or did you start too far early? Did it diminish?
So it seemed like it was a fairly linear gain. And now this is just over the 8 days of because the homeworks were released 8 days ahead of time, so those were the bounds that we could measure because that's how that was available. But I will say in a couple of the interviews, the students talked about, again, their process, which might include looking at the materials, whether it's the reading questions or the e-text or just looking at the topics that were going to be covered ahead of the lecture so that they felt like they were more prepared to engage during that class time. So I would imagine that there's some immediate or maybe a secondary relationship there. Yeah.
So the starting early effect and other phenotypes of cluster A could just be they're better students that you refer to. They have better study habits. And you said you got information from the registrar's office. So have you checked how it correlates to their other grades? Are they A students across the board in traditional classrooms too? Because a big predictor in intro bio, you can tell what students are going to do better at a big, large university by their other course grades.
Yeah. So we don't have previous grades because for almost all of them, these are students in the first in the fall. But the effect of starting early was consistent when we controlled for things like incoming SAT, ACT score, other demographics that we know are important. I think we had the math class that they were enrolled in as a proxy for mathematical reasoning, that kind of thing. So yeah, when we controlled for these other things, something else is going on there. And we're in the process of doing more exploration of how all these factors are related. But we may see an interactive effect of, for certain students, starting earlier even gives them a bigger bump. So we're exploring that more. But yeah, that is something that is consistent even when we control for those other things. Yep.
I'm curious, what you make of that. They're all eventually mostly getting the right answer, but they still are not performing the same in the class overall, if I'm understanding.
Yeah, so there's a few things to unpack there. So one is that this is interesting, yes, because they're persisting through and getting the correct answer. A third of the time, they need to get the correct answer in order to get the points, so there's going to be a necessary relationship there. But as I said, with the written homeworks, they're not required to do that. By and large, they do, but this separation is likely because of the written homework problems where they weren't required to keep going until you get it right. But those who did were part of this centroid, the centroid of this one group that was higher performing. Well, so what we're seeing is that overall, students are generally clustered up here in the, close to doing that for all of their problems. But we see that this is one of a number of factors, a number of behaviors that separate these two groups of students out into distinct typologies of students. And again, we were surprised to find that it was only, like, there were only two groups, that there was a generally higher performing and a generally lower performing group. We thought we might get, okay, here are the students who really, you know, they'll try it once and not go beyond that at all. And then here are the superstars, and maybe there's three or four groups in there. Because again, this is 474 students who represent, this is the standard 801 class. It's a big swath of students who are here. And so we thought we would see a more separation, more diversity in the clusters of types of students that we could determine.
There's also, we can make the hypothesis that the students can get the green check mark without really understanding what the green check mark, why they got the green check mark that they did. And that's what we saw in part in the Think Alouds.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that I would tie that into some of these other behaviors as well, that again, they hang together as a cluster. So the students who are reflecting more in between those checks too are eventually doing better on their grade that includes their final exam, that includes, you know, all the other facets of their participation.
And we see that Molly is standing up, so we assume that means we should stop.
Are you available to talk a little bit afterwards?
Yeah,
well,
of course.
Thank you so much, Jenny.
Thanks for having us.